I have to ask, what's it like walking around the streets of Sitka knowing that you've written a great novel that nobody's read yet?
Well, the notion that I've written a great novel is, I think, still up in the air.
Okay.
But I thank you for the question. It's nerve-wracking. This is the hardest time for me as a writer. I've worked, 6 years on and off on this book, and it's been through lots of different lives. I've changed it and rewritten it and written it, and you just never really know what the reception is going to be. So part of what keeps writer's block at bay is knowing that, you can always have a chance to keep working on it. I just keep rewriting it. But once you stop and you send it out into the world, then you just sort of like, I plug my ears and just hope for the best.
You're probably going to do the whole author tour and the book signing thing, and you'll probably talk to other media folks too, and everybody's going to ask you this question, and I'll ask it too. You're jumping the tracks here. You're getting off the Cecil Younger beat and into new territory. And what was it like writing a novel without that familiar voice of Cecil Younger's batting around in your head?
I think that's probably what took me so long in writing it, was learning to write in the third person and learning to write in a voice that wasn't so familiar. You know, this was a whole new enterprise in it, and it took a long time just to get used to the new voice. And I'm really comfortable with the Cecil voice. You know, and for they were written in the first person, meaning the Cecil is speaking. I walk out the door. I do these and things, and it's easy to sort of slip into my sort of autobiographical Cecil costume and channel that voice, but writing in the third person, writing a much bigger, more complicated book was a real challenge. But once I did it for a while, I really enjoyed the differences.
Where did these new characters come from? Where did Slippery Wilson come from and Ellie Hobbs?
Well, a lot of these people were inspired by sitkins and residents of the Pioneer Home that I knew all the way from the early 80s. On up to today. And the story really started with a current resident of the Pioneer Home, Robert DeArmond, who in 1931 took a dory from Sitka down to Tacoma to go to college. And he wrote about that in this wonderful little book called Voyage in a Dory. And I read that, and I was really inspired by that. And in the early 80s, I spent a lot of time in the Pioneer Home interviewing people, talking to people, and they were of that era, adults before the war, before the Second World War in Alaska. And I'm interested in that period of Alaskan culture and lore. I think it would have been a really exciting time to be here. And so then I just used images and memories and characters. Slippery Wilson Slippery is his nickname. His real name is Jack Wilson. And there is a Jack Wilson in my life. It was my first boss back in the Cascade Mountains in Washington. When I was 13 years old, I went to work for Jack Wilson. And he had run away from home, and he had worked as a riveter on the Grand Coulee Dam and had been building ships in San Francisco. And he was a real influence on me. He was the first guy, when I was a kid, he was the first guy that I ever knew that could really cuss, you know what I mean, and talk politics. And he was the first guy that ever really treated me like an adult. And so I pay some homage to him in this book.
What about Ellie?
Ellie was inspired by a woman that I met in the Pioneer Home, Olga Kleitzing, who grew up on the Lucky Me homestead over in Juneau. And she was one of the first women to ever run her own fishing boat in southeastern Alaska. And she was a deep admirer of Amelia Earhart. And she was a wonderful woman. I knew her in the Pioneer Home years ago. She's gone now. Just one of these real adventurous souls. I made her. She wasn't. Olga Kleitzing was not a radical or an anarchist in any way. She was, but she did aspire to have been a pilot.
Well, that was my next question, John. Is how many communists are living over there in the Pioneer Home?
Well, there used to be more.
Yeah.
Back in 1919, after the Centralia riots and labor troubles in the state of Washington, Washington started enforcing the sedition laws in the state. And so, having been a member of any radical organization, particularly the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, could get you 10 years in jail. So a lot of those old wobblies took off and left Washington State. And when I came here in the 70s, you could find some of these old radicals parked out in Fox Farms or up in Greentop or over in the Taku River. A lot of these old radicals were there in Alaska, maybe not all connected up, but most of them still pretty fiery in their rhetoric.
You know, I think someone who comes to this novel, The Big Both Ways, is going to recognize this era. They're going to recognize it from their high school history class, you know, the Hoovervilles and, mm-hmm. and things, but they're not going to place it in the Pacific Northwest. It's like, for somebody like me who grew up in the Midwest, this chapter of American history is blank. The labor movement before World War II in the Pacific Northwest. But somehow you got your hooks into it big time here.
Yeah, in meeting people like Bill Hills from Greentop, who's also gone now, who had been a member of the IWW, and then from my reading and history, it was a lively time. You know, any time you have people doing dangerous work for low wages and bad living conditions, you're going to have labor movement struggles, and you're going to have radicalism, and the Pacific Northwest was ripe for that in the era between World War I and World War II, and there were many dramatic improvements to making those jobs much safer and more civilized and better paid, and all of those came through people just standing up for themselves and in a collective way.
2 or 3 years ago, I read Bob Darman's book, too. I think it was part of Sitka Reed's about rowing the dory. When did the dory story unite with the labor story?
Well, you know, I'm constantly collecting ideas and stories and images that I just think are great. And I don't know why sometimes I think they're great, but I'll hear somebody say something or I'll see something, and I'll think, wow, that's cool. And I don't know why it is, but I'll just store it away. And, oh, geez, back in the early 80s, maybe 1982 or so, I heard about how Robert DeArmond had rowed a dory from Sitka down all the way through Puget Sound. I just thought, you know, I was young and adventurous then. I just thought, wow, that is a great story. I'd like to know more about it. And I just sort of sat it in my files. And that same summer, I was in Greentop, and I met these old IWW characters. And I just thought, wow, they were somebody that I had never met before. And then in my reading, things just sort of coalesce, a lot like, you know, how the seasons bring all different kinds of fish and birds in together, and they all sort of mill around together and make a whole new season. That's sort of the way I end up creating one whole story. I just have all of these elements of things that I think are interesting and neat and figure out how best they can all flow together.
You know, what you just said to me makes perfect sense. I understand sort of the imagery you're after. And this book, you know, The Boat, it does involve a journey in a small open rowboat, and you have to be very conscious of the tides, and the people are observant of all kinds of things that we're not necessarily paying attention to in power craft and things. But the story, in a larger sense, there's lots of ebb and drift, and people just seem caught in currents you know, thematically. And I just wonder how this must have sounded in some publisher's office as you're trying to sell it. I mean, because I guess I represent, you know, somebody who's going to buy this book and read it. I live in Alaska, have for a long time, and, you know, obviously thoroughly enjoyed it. But how does some suit get it?
Well, they didn't. This book made the rounds of every New York publisher, and they just thought, no, you know, they wanted something different from me. And it wasn't until I got it in the hands of Sarah Jude at Alaska Northwest Books, and she really responded to it, and she got it. That's the most you can hope for when you're a writer, is to work on something really hard and then find somebody who gets it, who understands the imagery, who understands the story. And she championed it for me at her company. And that's how books happen anymore, is you have to find one person that really gets it, that appreciates the imagery and what goes into a book. And then they have to champion it to the sales force and to the marketing people. And Sarah did that for this book, and I'll always be grateful.
You know, I read an advanced copy of The Big Both Ways right after the Academy Awards, when No Country for Old Men won Best Picture. And so I watched that film while I was reading this book, and there, I don't know if you've seen it or not, there's the Josh Brolin character says something to his wife to the effect that, "I'm about to do the stupidest thing I've ever done," and he sets off on this journey of sorts. I don't want to give the movie away, but he's sort of swept up in events in the same way that Slippery Wilson kind of makes, sort of has the same sort of internal dialogue with himself. "I'm about to do something very stupid, and I may not be able to get out of this."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gets caught up in the current of events, and with a beautiful woman that helps motivate him, who also steals all of his money at first, so he's got to go get the money, and that's part of the challenge of, you know, when I like characters who are not your traditional heroes. Guys like Slippery Wilson are more acted upon than acting, if you see what I mean. He is not the guy that initiates all this adventure. He's the guy that is looking around and trying to decide what to do. And I do that partly because I relate to that. I experience life sometimes, I think, maybe too much. It's kind of a hallucination that I'm just always, as a writer, trying to wake up from, trying to, you know, say, "Wow, is this really happening to me? And what do I do now? And what are my next choices?" And that's what happens with Slippery.
I wondered if there was some sort of universal experience common to men there, because I think I had heard somewhere, in relation to the movie No Country for Old Men and the Josh Brolin character, that, you know, what guy who had $2 million fall into his lap wouldn't try and do what that character did, you know, and get away with it? And in a sense, I think at every point in some man's life, he does have a conversation along the lines of Slippery Wilson's, where he says, "This is totally stupid, but I'm doing it anyway."
Doing it anyway. Caught up in events, and then you just try to act through instinct, right? But that instinct is being shaped by all this swirl of everything else, all the strong characters around you, and historical events that seem to flow both ways.
Did the riots at the Juno Douglas mine happen as you describe them in your story?
Well, they did happen. There was a riot. The Juno Douglas miners went out on strike in the early spring of 1935, and the management interest did organize a separate miners association, kind of a fake union. And they organized a march of the scabs to get jobs in the mine. And when they did that, the striking miners attacked them. And there was a riot in which people were seriously injured, but no one was killed. And I have read reports that the American Communist Party, all the different labor unions, were sending radical organizers in to try to break this strike and to try to break the the Miners Association and to try to resolve the strike in favor of the striking union. And there was all kinds of intrigue that went on. But the details of my adventure, the killings that happened, are fictionalized.
I guess I ought to say that this is crime fiction, and it does have an interesting policeman in it from Seattle. George Hansen is his name. I'm wondering, though, as interesting a character as George Hansen is, was there ever a point in the development of this story when you considered just dropping the crime aspect of it altogether and just going with the labor story, the journey story? At what point did you decide that this genre, that crime detection, crime fiction, was the best genre to tell this really multifaceted story?
Like it or not, I'm known as a crime writer. I have some experience in crime working as a criminal investigator. So I thought that was going to be my best shot at being able to sell a book, purely mercenary reasons. But I also am interested, I think that crime stories are handy in a way to develop the motivation for the hunt, you know, and the motivation for a journey and an action, someone trying to escape and someone trying to catch them. That's a good way to get an adventure started. And it's so early on I thought, since there was a lot of violence associated with the labor movement and there was a lot of intrigue involved and double dealing and double agents, so to speak, that I thought it was a fertile ground for that kind of crime story. So I knew I was going to write a crime story, and because it would seem to fit in that time in history, and also it's just a good device for storytelling.
One last thing, John. Mm-hmm. There is a yellow bird in this story, and this could be fodder for college seminars for years to come.
Oh, I hope so.
But is there anything now, here and now, that you would like us that you would like to say about the yellow bird that might crack open the mysteries of this novel in some way that people might not initially realize?
Well, there is a yellow bird. There's a young girl who owns a cockatiel, and she gets swept up in this crime and adventure, and she has to go along on the Dora trip, but she won't leave her cockatiel behind. So this little girl and this yellow bird have to go on up. And I can imagine the freshman college papers that were written about the symbolism about this bird. And I think all of those will have merit. But the yellow bird started with me. We owned a cockatiel named Crow. And our household were not a good fit. He was just this wild, crazy bird. And fortunately, Crow found a much happier home. But while he was with us, we would sometimes, he would fly around our house loose all the time, and but we would take him outside on sunny days and give him a bath. I'd put the hose down and he'd hose himself off, and I just remember seeing the crows and the ravens come by, and they would sit on the picnic table and look at this yellow bird in a cage. And you know how crows will cock their head like, what the heck? And they're looking, and they kind of want his food, and they're looking at it. And I saw that, and I just thought, there's something there. That's something really interesting about having a caged bird in wild Alaska. So when I started drafting out this story, I just put our bird in it, just stuck him in there. He had to be there.
If I wrote a paper about this, I don't think I'd get a C on it.
No, I just had to dump him in. You know, if I had a basset hound, maybe that basset hound would have been in the dory. I don't know.
All right. John, what's next? Have you got another novel in the works? Are you moving in a new direction with The Big Both Ways? Are we going to see more of this type of story with a fresh cast, or this?
Well, I'm not really sure. My plan is that The Big Both Ways is the first in another series based around a small town in Alaska. And that town is called Cold Storage, Alaska. And I have another novel called Cold Storage, Alaska, that which will be ready to go here pretty soon. And so the characters in The Big Both Ways are part of the founding of this little town. And I'm hoping to write a series of novels that will just pick up this town in different parts of history. There'll be contemporary stories and, you know, stories in all parts of the history of this little town, with a changing cast of characters that with and threads of their personal history that run through it.
I think that's very unique to Alaska in many ways, too. We do have these small towns, but the diversity of experience of the inhabitants of the towns is really extreme sometimes.
Oh, yeah. You can get all kinds of conflict and all kinds of fun craziness going on in a small town. It's inspired originally by the Cannery Row books of John Steinbeck, that he took a town that he loved and then just had a cast of characters that go through it. So that's what I would like to do. I'd like to have this town. And for the first time, I'm going to fictionalize it, my own Alaskan universe. It's a mixture of Pelican and Port Alexander and Tanaki, but it'll be my own little Alaskan coastal boardwalk town.
All right. John Straley, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Rob.